Hello, come in. Lie down. Relax. Take a deep breath in. And now breathe out. We'll be your therapists today. You're listening to Triathlon Therapy.
That's too much time. Look at Steve McKenna. Steve, what are you doing, Steve? That's too much time. Advantage Reed.
All right, let's fire
we
up.
We have an absolute legend in the sport, Aaron Royal, who's a two-time Olympian. He's won races all over the world of ITU and long course races, Olympic distance, non-drafting. You're the man, Aaron. Thanks for coming on. We wanted to get Aaron on, especially because he is a two-time Olympian, and chat a little bit about his experience and what the Olympic process is like, what the actual racing the games is like, but also to give us some insights on what went down with both the men's and women's race in Paris. And given that we watched it, but like I haven't raced ITU. Clint certainly hasn't, and so we need to get your good insights into it. So Aaron, welcome. Thanks for coming on.
No, cheers, guys. Thanks for having me. What a race. It was an unbelievable race. I think we were treated to, I think, one of the best races with just the conditions that we saw. The women's race, they had to go through so much with the wet conditions on those cobbles and probably the stronger current, or so it seemed like it was. It started to settle down a little bit because there was quite a lot of rain early in the morning. So I was there on the course watching, and at 5 a.m., so 3 hours before the start, there was quite a bit of rain coming down. And then the men started about 5 or 6 hours after that. So I think it sort of slowed down a little bit. So yeah, they had the tricky conditions. But yeah, I don't really know where to start, but it was, I think just, I sort of made a post that I think the Olympics is the greatest show on earth, and we were kind of treated to what I think was one of the greatest races that I was there. And because I was on the sidelines, right? So like the atmosphere was incredible. Like, and it's hard to really fathom or explain or get that across, but everyone that I've spoken to, and I've obviously got some good mates that are still racing short course racing, they said that was by far the best atmosphere that they've ever raced. And you know, those that were around in London, people still refer back to that as probably the best sort of atmosphere that they've raced in front of. And I think people are saying that this has trumped it. So yeah, kudos to those that were there standing on sideline that kind of, yeah, made it the case.
And with those swim conditions, were you sort of going, geez, I wish I was racing? Because amongst our friends, we were all thinking, geez, if this, with these conditions, there's a real chance like Matt Hauser and Schumann and a few guys might get a really solid gap on the field. And it almost played out that way. I think towards on the second lap, they had a bit of a gap and then sort of took a bad line and it all bunched back up again and the swim came together. But it was really, you know, as we saw in the women's race for Flora as well, like it was an opportunity for the really strong swimmers to get a breakaway.
Yeah. And I think it's really hard to fathom when you're watching on the TV how strong the current was, but everyone listening to this, and you guys now, if you want, go look at Rachel Klemmer's post that she just put on Instagram. And it's an overhead shot of the swimmers coming back into the current. And the females, they are not moving. Yeah. Like they are really, really struggling. So yeah, when you get a chance, go and look at her post and you can kind of see how strong that current was. Yeah, I think so. Obviously, I'm really good mates with a few of the guys there. Martin Van Riel is one of my best mates, and he's obviously, well, I mean, he's a strong athlete across the board. But you know, he's typically quite a good swimmer and a good, very good cyclist. And I think, yeah, he was kind of a little bit disappointed that he probably felt like there's a bit of a missed opportunity. They did have, like you said, quite strung out on that first lap, and probably didn't quite go on with it a little bit in that second lap.
Was he in that breakaway swim group?
Pretty much, yeah. Like he yeah. was, there was a couple off the front. I think like maybe two or three. Hauser was one of them with about two other guys.
Yeah.
And there was a group of about five or six behind, about 10 seconds that caught up midway through the first lap, that made like that first group of 10-ish. I think it was before then that next group of 20-odd that caught them. But the thing with the men's field at the moment is that there's so many good chasers from behind, probably the bulk of the stronger riders. So if you're talking Hayden Wild, obviously Christian Blumenfeld, Hayden obviously had Dylan McCulloch from New Zealand drop back to help pull that last little bit. So yeah, it was always, in my mind, I thought it was always going to play out the way that it did with it, on the men's side, at least with a group of 30 guys. I just felt like, yeah, there was too much horsepower coming from behind. And in the men's, sorry, in the women's field, I think it was, yeah, went to how I thought it would play out as well. You know, the typically in the women's side, the best bikers are also the best swimmers and pretty much the best runners as well. So if you're basically not going to be in that top 15 out of the water, then it was pretty much going to be race over.
The ladies look like it strung out pretty quickly in the water, and I think they did have a really bad current. Like when they went around that first turning buoy at the other end, when they went to take the right hand turn, they drifted probably 20 meters past the buoy before they realized obviously how insane the current was. But they strung out pretty quickly. But the coverage showed very, very well how brutal the group, like there was a three or four off the front you're talking about, but they were just, the group of men were just bashing the crap out of each other the whole swim, specifically like into the current. They were all obviously a bit frantic about trying to get to the edge of the water, to the edge of the river, to try and get out of the current a little bit. And they were just punching the shit out of each other the whole way.
Yeah, so when you said, Reedy, about did I wish I was out there, that is one thing that I do not miss about not doing short course racing, because middle distance, my thing is I'm not super fast. Like, so in short course, I did, you know, people always like, oh, you were a good swimmer, you weren't in the melee. I was like, well, I kind of was for the first 300 meters, and then because I was quite strong, I could get myself out of it once it settled down a bit. So that's one thing I don't miss about not doing short course racing. But So before the race, actually, I saw Phil Clayton, who most of us will probably know, the, you know, ex Surf Ironman champion. He's working for Team GB. He's been working with them for the last 4 years. Masterstroke now, when you look back on it, that what GB did with employing him, and they had, you know, 12-week camps with him replicating the swim currents, etc. But yeah, anyway, I saw him the day before, and he had a measuring device measuring how strong the current was. And he's like, oh, yeah, it was 1.3 meters per second. And I kind of like, oh, that kind of sounds fast, but I don't, you know, got nothing to reference it from. And then he said, well, picture this, the men, that won the 400 meters freestyle, they swim at 1.6 meters per second. So if you can sort of picture that, that's how fast they're swimming. And so the triathletes are having to swim 400 meters into a current that is basically coming against them almost at the speed that they swim the 400 meters to win the Olympics. So I guess once I heard that, I could kind of picture, wow, okay, that's how strong it actually was. But yeah, no, it really, like, I think, you know, I don't know, what do you guys think? Did it kind of make it add a bit of an excitement?
Oh, it made it really exciting. I mean, I've always said the more you can make, you know, things like elements to races that are like that, I think the better.
Reedy wants to add punching into racing, all right? So like, yeah. that's where he's
already, no, it's punching. Already in there.
Yeah.
It's already in there.
Yeah. I was thinking my one criticism of the course was I just feel like it's such a shame when they don't put a hill in there on the bike, because I just feel like it's just going to come back together without, and you don't get the chance for the really strong cyclists to shine. You know, someone like Martin Van Riel would have been, I imagine it's just if you put a few hills in there, even on a tight loop, it changes the dynamics so much.
Yeah, I mean, we're recording a day after the road race, and I'm sure you probably maybe caught a bit of that, right? Mm. And that was like an unbelievable course and unbelievable scenes and unbelievable racing. Yeah, I think they missed a trick. They could have definitely done something
and
like
then
that.
So, and you'd have to say, like, if with that, if they had a hill in the course, probably Flora could have taken another gold medal, or who knows? Like, it's it certainly opens up the race a lot more. Were you surprised with any of the top three for the women at all?
Julie Deren, yeah, that was a little bit surprising for me. I guess if you look back in, you know, back at her previous results, maybe shouldn't be so surprising. And also with her coach, Brett Sutton, he seems to get it right on the big days with his athletes. You know, so I guess it shouldn't be totally surprising. But no, I think Cassandra was for sure the out-and-out favorite. Just whether she was going to handle that home, you know, home crowd pressure. It's kind of crazy to think, but France have never won an Olympic individual medal. And, you know, it's all that's been talked about for the last 4 years. Can we get our first individual Olympic medal? So I couldn't imagine the type of pressure that she was under, and all of the French athletes, actually. So I guess that was the biggest question mark hanging over Cassandra, whether she was going to handle the pressure. I think for sure she was the best athlete physically, but mentally, was she able to handle that? And clearly she was. And Beth, no, I thought she was in there with obviously a good chance at a medal. One notable that I probably think was a little bit surprising that they weren't a bit more competitive was Georgia Taylor Brown. And maybe a little bit biased because she's part of the Leeds Tri Centre that I train with, and I was training with her quite a bit in Font-Romeu before her pre-Olympic training camp. And she was flying. So I thought that at least would have been with that lead group. You know, there was four of them up until the last lap. I thought she might have been up there a little bit more. But other than that, it kind of went to how I thought it would play out.
And then in terms of the men's race, where on course were you watching that run play out? And were you surprised when you ran Hayden down?
So I was watching just as they turned right to head into transition. So they ran past us and ran maybe like 400 meters past to do that last dead turn, which would have been 500 meters from the finish line, and then came back and just turned right, and they were onto the blue carpet. So we had a prime spot, but I had to get there at 5 a.m. for an 8 o'clock start to be there. Actually, so what we haven't spoke about yet is the postponement of the men's race. The races ended up being on Wednesday morning, both of them. And obviously it was meant to be Tuesday for the men, Wednesday for the women, right? And there was obviously a lot of talk on Monday whether it would be postponed. But like, could you imagine going to bed the night before the Olympics, going, are we racing tomorrow? And finding out at 4 a.m. when you look on your phone to see whether you've got an email from World Triathlon saying that, we're going ahead or we're not. Like, it's bonkers.
I think it's safe to say that nearly every one of those athletes would have checked their phone like a dozen times during the night waiting for that call to come through.
How do you sleep? How do you sleep? I think there was, so I know obviously just being quite close to the GB team with my wife, that I think they had their rule was, we will wake you if it's on. So don't set an alarm, don't check your phone. They had their room key. We will come and get you up. But even then, I don't think I could sleep, right? Like, I would just be worried that someone would come in I'd sleep through or whatever. But so we were meant to have, I was meant to have tickets, but obviously there was a whole kerfuffle with just what happened and the races changing. So we gave our tickets to some family of athletes that didn't end up having them. And anyway, so that's where I stood on course, just as they turned right. And I thought that Alex had it home. He had it sealed.
With 500 meters to go when they had that last little out and back, it looked like Alex had it. Yeah, because the coverage that we saw was from above, from about where you were, that last little out and back. They must have been able to have cameras in there for some reason. And so it was above. And then the next bit that the coverage showed was hitting the lead.
Yeah. We were looking left because Hauser was about to come through. Yep. So like, I was still there with Non and Emma Jackson, or Emma Box and Drew Box. Us four were there. And so we were like, okay, well, Hayden's one, Alex is second, Leo's third, that's a podium. Let's look the other way to see how's a cheer him on. He's got a few people around. He can maybe pick up a few spots. So we're looking left. And then next minute, I just kind of looked right and I was like, oh, that's Alex. I'm like, has Hayden gone past? And then you see Hayden behind and I'm like, no one, Alex has overtaken him. And like, obviously we just started screaming. More so because I know Alex quite well, again, been in the British system quite a lot over the last few years. And non being in British, like she was obviously cheering for Alex. So she just started screaming her lungs out, hanging out over the side of the railing. Yeah, unbelievable. So yeah, to answer your question, that's where I was stood, kind of long-winded answer, but that I was kind of stood there. And yeah, I thought from about 2K into the race, Hayden had this wrapped up.
It's funny because I, watching it, you know, I thought Alex went out, looked like harder than he normally does. And then sort of, I think he blew himself up a little bit in relative sense for someone who's, you know, but I said to my kids while I was watching it, I was like, he's such a good runner that I reckon, I don't think he'll catch Hayden, but I bet you he closes the gap towards the end because he can recover at 3 minute K pace, you know? So,
yeah.
And that was almost like, yeah, it was just, I mean, it was, you know, absolutely exhilarating to watch, but I thought for sure Hayden had it, but I did think Alex was going to come back to make it pretty close at the end. So, yeah.
Hayden, it was a card Hayden had to play, right? Like, you know, consistently over the last few years, they had been running together. They'd been off the front together. And Alex had his measure over the last K. And it always played out that way. So Hayden had to make it hard. And I heard in his post-race interview that they raced each other in Cagliari about 6 weeks before, and they went out hard like they normally do. They got a gap, and then after about 2K, Alex sort of slowed up a little bit. He was dictating the pace, and Hayden, they realized then that was their time to go. When he, after 2K, you're probably running 240 pace, like, yeah, okay, everyone's going to slow up. That's my time to go. But that's what he did, and he went out, and he obviously got the gap. And you know, kudos to Hayden, like he didn't die wondering. You know, can't, you know, I'm sure he's to come so close to an Olympic gold medal must be, you know, maybe not disappointed, but maybe heartbreaking a little bit that he was so close to it. But, you know, I think I'm sure if not already in time, he'll look back at that and just go, well, I literally did everything I could. And yeah, one thing also we didn't talk about is it was hot. Like it was actually really, really, really hot. And because of the rain in the morning, it was probably about 33 degrees, but the rain in the morning, there was still a lot of moisture in the air. The humidity was through the roof. And whilst I know a lot of them were doing a bit of heat prep, always the plan was 8 a.m. start. So finish at 9:45, typically before the heat really kicks in. But they didn't start until 11 a.m. because the women, they obviously raced on the same day and the women went first. And so finishing at basically 1 p.m. right in the heat of the day. And that's why last year Alex ran 28:45, I think, 10K. And this year it was, I mean, still quick, right? 29:40-ish. It's still really quick, but like a minute, everyone was thinking that, you know, based on the test event and last year when Alex ran 28:40 and he eased off in the last K, that it's going to take a 28:30 to win. But yeah, obviously the heat would have played a massive factor into the results as well, and possibly how Hayden kind of fell apart a little bit in that last couple of K.
Yeah, I think for any of the listeners out there, the humidity, that sort of temperature with humidity, it's for any runner, it's going to add a minute plus on your 10K time. So it makes those times even more astonishing, really. And it wasn't, apart from like the last 10K of the bike, they were all working pretty hard on the bike for a lot of it too, because there was, you know, especially Blumenfeld's group had to bridge back up and there was a lot going on. So I think it was, yeah, it's just absolutely incredible the sort of times they're putting down.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, you know, looking and even now not in the races so much, I kind of watch and I'm like, they're riding around in groups. Oh, it must be easy. They're hardly pedaling. And sometimes, yeah, that is the case, but often it's actually quite hard still, that bike leg, and very, very stochastic, very dynamic. So you know, whilst you might not be pedaling for 10 seconds, you're then, you know, 800 watts for 10 seconds, and then, you know, 30 seconds at 500 watts, and then not pedaling for 10 seconds. And so it's very, you know, up and down like that. So it is very draining on the legs.
Yeah. You could, I think, you could see that a lot, specifically in the female race, because of the wet. They were coming so cautiously into the corners and then just like giving it full noise out of nearly every corner, and just doing that for 40 Ks over and over and over is certainly going to take its toll.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sure. I, we always say the same thing to our athletes, like having a high average power is not the worst thing for your run legs. It's the surges that kill your run legs. And basically that bike leg was just surge after surge, you know? So it's, absolutely. I think it's important for people to realize that even with those, little pauses in pedaling, and even if the average power isn't that high, it's the amount of sprints you have to do that really, really fatigue the legs. So I guess moving a bit on to, one thing I wanted to ask you about, what are your thoughts? Like, obviously the GB team, they had a domestique role in the team. What's your thoughts around Olympic teams having a domestique? Is it, give us your quick thoughts on that one.
It's tough to say when, you know, it's the GB team have done it in Rio and now in Paris, and in Rio they went first and second, and now they've come first in Paris. I guess kind of the proof's in the pudding that it does work. It's really, really hard to say. So like in Tokyo, I was technically a domestique or a helper or whatever you want to call it to try and help Jake. But I think what we got wrong there is, one, we never really practiced it, and two, there wasn't a lot of communication around like directly what everyone's role is. So I think you need to be clear on what is going to happen, and what the expectations are. And so I think that's where we got it wrong a little bit in Tokyo. But, and you know, if you look at, so Dylan McCulloch for Hayden Wild was Hayden Wild's domestique, and I don't know whether what their plans were, but he kind of was sat in the front group for the first half of the bike, and eventually when he did drop back, you know, he closed the gap within half a lap. So you could argue that it did work there. I don't know whether it's right or wrong. I kind of don't really have an opinion either way yet, but I think you're going to see it more and more, especially with the relay. So if you don't have an individual athlete that you think is a medal potential, then they're going to pick people that, one, tick the box for the relay. That's probably the main priority. And then two, can they help someone deliver an Olympic medal?
Ben, what do you think about it?
Well, so in your scenario, Aaron, and you said it wasn't really discussed and technically, or like you were kind of a domestique. Would you have preferred in that scenario that they said, this is, if you're told to, this is what we want from you? Or was it just kind of not really discussed?
No, 100%. Like, I just wanted clarity on what the expectations were.
Yep.
And, you know, and it was like, we had like, it was just too complicated as well. There was supposed to be like this traffic light system. So like traffic light, like red, yellow, amber, green, and coaches on the side of the road, like red meant this, amber meant this, green meant this. And like, when you're racing around at the Olympic Games with, well, there wasn't crowds in Tokyo, but you got your head down, like you're breathing out your ass, you don't take note of a board with a coach like on the side of the road. Like you just don't see it. I didn't see the board for the first two laps. So I had no idea what I was meant to do. Was I meant to drop back to Jake that was 30 seconds behind and try and help that group? You know, so in that instance, I just think, yeah. And like, we've had a whole debrief on this. So I'm not really talking out of context here or out of turn. You know, we've had a big debrief, and that was kind of the feedback that a lot of us said, is that if you're going to go down this route, then make sure that everyone understands their role, be direct, don't have any ambiguity, and just like clear understanding of what the role was meant to be.
Well, I think it's similar to like what we're talking about earlier with like adding a hill into the course, or the swim being a bit different. It'd certainly add to the, like, the viewing experience if we knew, and it kind of already did with New Zealand sending someone back to help bridge the gap. Like, it certainly makes watching it more enjoyable, but I just don't know, like, for someone like yourself, Aaron, you'd way rather go there and just like go for broke, you know, race for yourself. You're not there to you're not there to try and just get one medal. It's like you can all go and do your best.
Yeah, no, 100%. Like, yeah, but I knew that the way the policy was written, like I kind of knew that I wasn't, especially in Tokyo, I wasn't an individual medal chance. So the way the policy was written is either you're a chance to help the relay or you're there to help someone else. So I kind of like knew, but like I said, just clear instructions. Yeah. But I think we're going to see it more, to be honest.
Yeah, I think more. That as long as the rules are the way they are, or like as I think that it just makes sense, and you got to do what you can to win a medal. I think it's obviously a real shame when someone would potentially miss out who does have a medal chance. And of course, it sucks for the person who might be the second or third best in their country but doesn't have a medal chance. Mm. Like sports's never fair, unfortunately. But you got to feel for people in that situation. There's obviously been that's happened quite a few times over the years. What was the name of the of Alex's domestique?
Sam Dickinson. So he
I think even that, I mean, that's taking it to the extreme, right? Where he doesn't even do the run, so that he can save himself for the team relay. That for me was a bit like, oh, I don't know how I feel about that. And I still don't know how I feel about it. But it's, I could understand if people were really frustrated at that. Like, you know, you're not even going to finish the race and show the respect to everyone else, you know, but,
he's a prime example. Like, so he was selected over Johnny Brownlee, right? So, I mean, Johnny hasn't been the same Johnny that we've got to know over the last three Olympics, but, you know, he's still Johnny Brownlee and he still delivered leading into Tokyo. He was still not the Johnny Brownlee that we knew in those 4 years, but then he came to Tokyo and he was fifth in the individual and put together the fastest relay leg of anyone on the day and to help GB win Olympic gold. So, in that instance, yeah, he's probably looking at that going, well, I could have done a good domestique role or
and had a chance.
And
not to mention the amount of funding he's brought towards GB Triathlon through his medals over the years. Like, I'd be furious if I was him.
And this isn't me saying either, because I train with both of them. So they're both based in Leeds, Dicko and Johnny. So I'm not sitting here saying that one should have been selected over the other, but you know, we're talking about examples here of people that may be sitting back being a bit bereaved of selections, and I'm sure him watching that probably would have felt that way.
I think we're conscious of your time, so we'll move more on to chatting about you and less about the Olympics. obviously you've had some great success with the, you know, you'd already dipped your toe a little bit in middle distance racing, and then you went, you know, the full hog. And you know, you were one of those athletes that I always said, oh, as soon as Aaron makes the switch, he's going to do really well. First of all, are you enjoying it different to, like, is there a different level of enjoyment? Is it fresh, something new for you after so many years of racing?
I am enjoying it. I think like more so now, which is maybe a little bit strange because I probably had some better results as soon as I switched over. But like to give it an example as to why it took a little bit of time maybe to enjoy it is that like it's a very much a solo mission, right? So I've been so used to traveling around with the Australian team, staying with the Australians in the same hotel, going to the pool together, like, you know, everything around the races, you're with a team. Whereas I remember doing my first race in Gran Canaria. I dipped my toes in a few races, but my first year racing where I was just concentrated on meter distance races, I went to do Challenge Gran Canaria and I flew out. It was just off the back of a Leeds winter. So I flew out a few days earlier, nice weather. I was like, oh, well, I'll spend a week out there. And my wife's got a full-time job now, so she didn't travel with me. So I was literally there by myself. And the whole week I was like eating breakfast by myself, going out training by myself, doing everything by myself. And I'm like, I don't know if this is for me. Like, this is not what I'm used to. And then, of course, over time you get friends and so you talk to people that are going to races and so that the enjoyment side of things came back. And so, yeah, I do really enjoy it. I miss, like, when I watched like the Olympics and the dynamics and the close racing and the being shoulder to shoulder with people, I'd miss that side of things a little bit. Like, it is very much your own effort, and I think, we'll maybe talk about it a little bit. T100s are probably going a bit more like short course racing in that it is a lot closer, and obviously, yeah, the racing is just much tighter. Yeah, to answer your question, I am enjoying it. I've had a bit of a mixed bag this year, I think, for a few different reasons. So I've done the four T100 races this year, and so we've done Miami, Singapore, San Francisco, and then London just a couple of weeks ago. Yeah, Miami was early in the year, and I was 10th there, so I was actually quite pleased with that. Like, I was going in with not high expectations. And then Singapore, actually, looking back on it now, I was quite pleased with that. Like, I was 7th. I went out to Malaysia like a week before to try and get used to the heat, and I probably cooked myself a little bit too much. So came into the race maybe a little bit overdone. And so
And
to come
I
out with
have
7th, I was
always
like,
remembered you, Aaron, just from the few times that we raced. I seem to remember you being very sweaty. Do you have a high sweat rate?
I actually don't.
Okay.
My sweat rate's not too bad.
Okay.
But I don't.
How many liters per hour would you lose on a in on the run in a race like Singapore?
I can't remember. I have done it before, but I can't remember the exact numbers.
Yep.
But I'm not. I wouldn't say I'm particularly good in the heat, though. I wouldn't say I'm bad. I kind of. I'd say I probably sit in that middle range where it affects me, but probably as it does for most people. And yeah, then on to San Francisco, I got COVID the week before, and so I battled my way through half the race and was useless and pulled out. And then yeah, London was just a really, really bad day. I dropped down from altitude real late, and it's kind of worked for me in the past, and also hasn't. And this one just didn't. So yeah, four races in, two okay ones, two not so good ones. And the way the series works is that our three best count. So and I've got another four races to try and better those. So I've got two decent ones on the board, and I kind of, yeah, need another decent one to be in the hunt for the, well, a decent result in the series.
So in terms of the T100 series, is it a lot more like when you're racing draft legal, where you do have some help along the way with logistics and you're not
Oh,
completely
right, yeah.
solo?
Sorry, I thought you were talking about touching on the draft in because
Oh,
it has
but
there
yeah,
has
well,
there has been
now you
quite a
brought it up, mate. No.
yeah. Well, on that, I think on the draft, like, it's I just don't know if these courses, like, because they're such tight courses, they're really intent on having tight laps, technical courses, which I think is good. But also, when the level is so close, like when there's 15 guys getting out of the water within 15 seconds of each other onto a course that's super tight, super narrow, U-turn every 4K. I mean, it's really hard to avoid what we're seeing. So, like, there is some drafting going on, and eventually, I don't know whether you saw London, but halfway through the bike, like, it did sort of even itself out a little bit. So yeah, I think there's probably some things that need to change on the course side of things to
Well,
really address that.
it's kind of hard for them, right? Because they're damned if they do, damned if they don't, where they need to have lapped courses to keep it interesting, to keep it probably to keep the costs down when they're trying to shut down roads in certain, very dense areas. And so they have to have lapped courses and keep it tight like that. And like what we just said about the Olympics, you want interesting, like technical type courses to make it, the viewing good. So it's probably just going to happen. But no, I was referring to in terms of like it seems like T100 is a pretty professional like setup with the way that they look after you guys. So you're probably finding a bit more like the draft legal setup where you've got help along the way.
Yeah, you do. Yeah, so everyone stays at the same hotel. It won't you get yourself to the race. Once you get there, everything's covered. Pick you up from the airport, hotel, massage, bike mechanic. Sometimes they have food on, lane hire, get yourself back into the pool. They get you to back and forth to the pool. So yeah, they do really, really look after us. I think some of the athletes actually don't like that, as in, you know, staying in the same hotel. I don't know what you would have been like, Reedy, but
yeah, I enjoy it. I was a bit like you. I found a lot of my career, I found extremely lonely, which is why I'd gravitate to training in the same places where I knew I had like Apo in Boulder or certain, you know, a few bunch of guys. And I used to love it when we all stayed at the same race hotel, you know, like, cause I need that community. And I also, you know, I didn't travel with my wife was always working. And so I didn't have a partner to travel with. So, yeah, I'm like you, I very much preferred that sort of setup, and it just, but it wasn't often around.
Yeah, no, it is good. I'd say like sometimes you're like, I just wanted to go down and get a coffee, and you see five athletes, and it takes you an hour and a half because you chat to someone every single 5 meters that you walk because you see someone. But now, as a whole, it is a really good experience. You know, the PTO are really taking care of the athletes, you know, both financially, but also just the little things that they're trying to do to make the experience, you know, the best possible it can be for the athletes.
Can I get into the specifics around how your training has changed from ITU to middle distance racing? I mean, is it the obvious stuff, like just a lot more efforts, like sustained efforts on the bike? Like has the running volume dropped off compared to ITU? What's the go?
It has and it hasn't changed. I have gone through. So initially I was, well, the back end of my short course career, I was coached by Joel Filio. Then I kind of did my own for a little bit. And I was kind of, if I look back now, I used to think that I had no idea what I was doing. But, you know, I've been in the sport for a while, so I think I probably had a decent idea. And I was getting all right results. But I thought that I needed to do, like, a lot more volume, or not so much a lot more volume, but a lot more, you know, longer efforts, which is probably true, especially on the bike. But I do feel like, you know, I got into the habit of doing like these loads of longer reps at say like the 320 run pace. And initially that felt really easy because I'd come from doing a lot of shorter efforts, but a lot of efforts like sub 3 minute K pace type stuff, and so 320s felt really easy, and I got into a place where 320 actually didn't feel that easy anymore because that's all I ever really did. So I've kind of changed a little bit my mindset into like, I still need to be efficient and be prepared to sort of run at that race pace effort, but if that's all you ever do, then eventually that's going to actually feel quite hard. So sort of changed the mindset a little bit now that I still need to be able to, I still want to be able to run fast. I still want to be able to have, you know, I mean, my run was never that quick, but I still want to always be able to be in shape that I could run like a 14:30 sort of 5K. That's like in my mind where I sort of feel like I need to sit, and then everything sort of flows off the back of that. You know, if I can always stay in that sort of shape, then yeah, that sort of race pace effort hopefully will always feel quite comfortable. But the way the racing is at the moment, especially on the men's side, it's in the T100, I've said it for a while now, I feel like it's almost raced at Olympic distance intensity, and then who can just hold on the longest. Because obviously you can't keep Olympic distance intensity, what is an hour 40 race, for 3 hours 20 at the T100 distance. But yeah, I feel like that's how it's kind of raced at the moment. And that's why we're not seeing, it's not super quick runs. If you can get off the bike at the front and run, you know, 320 pace, or yeah, 320 to 325, you're on the podium pretty much every time.
Do you just think people are over biking?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
So over biking, and then just, it's just shoes on and just throw it out there and see what happens. Is that how it feels for a lot of the time?
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah. And, you know, you've got like people like Ditlev has really improved his swim. So, you know, he used to be about 2 minutes down. Sometimes now he's only 30 seconds down. So obviously he's reaching the front a lot earlier and he wants to obviously play to his strengths. So push the bike. And yeah, so you've just got this weird dynamic now where, yeah, the really strong bikers are quite close starting the bike. And so they're, yeah, it's just, yeah, quite, it, basically it's a flat out race the whole way pretty much.
So you've been around, like you've been going at triathlon for a very long time, right? Because I remember when I first started doing triathlon, I did a camp in Wollongong, I think, and you were there. And you must be, what, 4 or 5 years younger than me. You hadn't hit puberty at that point, but I remember you just flying past me in every session. And I was like, I was a full-grown man, just like, what the hell? And then, yeah, so that you must have been started when you were, what, 12, 13? Sort of?
Yeah, pretty much. Like, I was a swimmer, grew up as a swimmer, and then just having good fitness through swimming was all right at running, like, you know, the school cross country. And I think it was about 12 years old that my swim coach at the time just said he did triathlon himself. He's like, hey, why don't you give that a go? And yeah, it kind of, that the rest is history, as they say. But you know, I guess at the time, like, I was sick, you know, as we know in Australia, swim coaches are mad. It's maybe not just Australians that are like this, but you know, I think I was 12 years old swimming 8-9 times a week. And so the opportunity to do triathlon, where, like, you know, what kid doesn't like riding their bike? I was like, if I can replace a couple of swims with some riding my bike, like, how awesome is that? And yeah, so that's kind of like how I got into it. So yeah, I've been around for a while, Reedy. I've got some grey hairs.
No wonder you hadn't hit puberty with that much training.
Yeah, I know. Yeah,
stunted your growth. Probably did a bit of an apo. I remember he took a year off at like 18 or 19, or maybe older. And he grew another three centimeters, and then got some hairs on his.
So me and Apo, actually, we're the same age. So we grew up racing each other all through juniors. Like, so he started as a swimmer as well.
Yeah,
so I remember racing Apo as like a 12-year-old in the 200 butterfly, I think it was. I remember chatting to him after the race. Yeah, so yeah, me, Apo, and I have been around for pretty much the same amount of years.
Yeah. Old what, dogs.
Yeah. What's the rest of the year entail for you, Aaron?
So I'm going to race the Paralympics. Well, guide someone for the Paralympics, or someone, Sam Harding, his name is, for the Paralympics. So that's why I'm up in St. Moritz now. He's actually just gone out for a long run. Yeah. So that's coming up. That's in 4 weeks' time, I think, which is pretty exciting. I think we're maybe, I'd say, an outside chance at a medal. He switched across from athletics. So he was in Tokyo for the, I think it was 1500. So he's obviously quite a good runner. We're trying to get his swim and bike up now to be competitive with the other guys. But yeah, that's up in 4 weeks' time. And then straight back to the T100 series. I think probably there's 8 races. For me, I think that's probably as much as I could fit in. There is a gap at the moment in T100 racing. So had I not been doing the Paralympics, I maybe would have done another half somewhere else. But yeah, so we've got 4 more races of the series to go. So the next one's in Ibiza, then we go to Las Vegas, Dubai, and then the grand final, which is in November. I was toying with the idea of a full distance. My coach, who I'm sure you guys know, Dan Plews, so I know definitely Reedy, you've been coached by him, I think, before. Mm. He actually thinks, but from the testing, my physiology will suit an Ironman. But yeah, it's just a lot at the moment with the T100 series. And I don't think, some people can do it, but I don't think I'm not good enough to be able to sort of switch between the two. So we'll park that for this year and see what the calendar comes up with next year.
That was going to be my final question, but I do think you will be really good at Ironman. And if Dan says you are, because the testing, you almost certainly will be. But yeah, I think if you do switching back and forth between middle distance and Ironman, there's a few select few that can do it, but for most people, I'm always like, it's a real battle because that 1435K that you were talking about, you could say goodbye to that.
Yeah.
You just get you put on so much size in the legs for 180K TT and it just changes things, right? But I mean, there's guys that can do it. Obviously, you know, you've got your freaks of nature out there and you're pretty freakish. So never say never. But I think when you do an Ironman, please do it properly. Don't just jump into it on a last minute thought because I think you'll crush it.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Like I was maybe going to line up and do Israel in the end it got canned, but I was going to maybe do that last year as my debut, but before it actually got canned, I pulled the pin because I was just not, you know, it was October time. It had already been a pretty big year and I just wasn't ready to try and dive headfirst into my first Ironman prep. So we went and did a few other halves and tried to just finished off the year that way. But yeah, for sure. If I do one, it's going to be, try and prepare for it properly.
So you're 34 now? 33?
Yes, 34. So got a couple more years, I reckon, before.
You got heaps more years.
Like you said, though, Reedy, mate, I've been around for ages, so it's it's especially now with the PTO series or T100 series, like 8 high level races. It's hard.
How is the body? Is there any sort of long term issues from so many years of punishing yourself?
Achilles, like every morning I'm hobbling out of bed. But touch wood, I got a pretty good routine now that it gets by. You know, I just can't get out. I can't get up and get out the door within 10 minutes for a run. Just that takes a bit of time. Other than that, I've been all right. Like tendon issues along the way. Touch wood, I've only ever really had one bone issue, which was a stress reaction in my toes. I've been all right, especially for a career that's gone for so long.
Yeah, mate, it's been an amazing career and I'm sure it's only going to get better. So we're really grateful for you coming on. Great insights on the Olympics and cool to hear about everything you're up to and all the best for the rest of the season. I think we will be watching and cheering for you.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. I don't know when this is going out, but obviously we've got the mixed team relay tomorrow, which we didn't really talk about. But
who's going to win? That was what I was going to ask you.
It's hard to go past France, right? They went first in the females, first and fourth in the females, and third and fourth in the men's. And GB will give them a red hot crack. So France, GB, Germany, if the race goes ahead tomorrow, then we could have the same scenario. The water quality has been quite bad again, so they haven't been able to get in over the last couple of days because, the water quality didn't meet thresholds, but it'll probably magically be good to go tomorrow morning at 8 a.m. So, 8 a.m. Paris time, 4 p.m. Australian time.
And then no one will be able to race for the rest of the year because they're all sick.
Yeah.
No one got sick though that you know of from the.
I've heard one or two, but that's pretty standard. You know, whether it's the water or there's people living in a village with 10,000 other athletes from all over the world. You know, that's pretty standard. I think if you only got a couple out of 110 athletes.
I did want to ask you about that. Do you have to fly? One quick
slide. No, go for it. Yeah.
The Olympic Village, like, is it a cesspit of just mass orgies or what's going on there?
He's married, Reedy.
Yeah. The two times I'm sure it is, but I'm not the right guy to ask. My wife, Non, she was in Rio with me. So we probably lived a very different life to some of the people in the village, but it is true. There is condom dispensers everywhere.
I like that they had, they made that everyone have single beds. I think this time around there was like, anti-bonk beds, so they were trying to stop people having so much sex. I was like,
yeah,
pretty sure you can still have sex in a single bed.
Yeah. When there's, where there's a will, there's a way, right? But it is it is funny though, those condom dispensers, they're kind of like not in inconspicuous way, like in, you know, hidden away. It's like in the dining hall, there's like four or five. And so
you go see people, everyone.
Young, that's it. And everyone's like, a whole village.
Young testosterone-filled guys would just, they would thrive on being able to go up and do that in front of everyone. So in terms of sponsors, Aaron, do you want to give anyone a shout out?
Yeah, I mean, you can, go to my Instagram. They're all there. But I'm quite lucky that I've been supported over the last few years for, by some good sponsors. So yeah. TeleRX is, you might have seen my latest race suit that they've put together.
That was exactly where I was going with this, mate. Don't ever give up on the white suit. There's only a few people who can pull it off and you are one of them. So keep doing it.
You sure? Even with like a big eggplant and with erectile dysfunction and a taco right next to my penis saying vaginal health. And but, you sure you still think so?
I'm all about it. Isn't there a flame down in your region too?
Yeah. So UTI. So yep. You can get all of these things. If you're in America, TeleRX, they've got you covered. Go check it out.
We're going to use that picture of
you got a discount code for my friend Burkle.
he's already a frequent customer, I think. Rashes. I think that's his number one item. Something to do with rashes or I can't quite remember.
All right, Aaron, thanks heaps, mate.
Thanks so much.
All the best. No worries, guys.
We'll chat to you later. Guys. See ya.
Yeah.